You know, it's getting scarier and scarier all the time. You know, the other day, Ed, it's not been more than a week ago, a friend of mine who has one of these recording things, you know, where when he goes out, he says into the recording, "This is a recorded announcement. Please leave your message when you hear the beeps." Well, the other day, he was home. And he was sitting there, and the phone rings, and he picks up the phone, and he puts it to his ear, and this guy says, "Hello, Fred." He says, "Yes." "Oh," he says, "oh, you're there?" He says, "Yes, this is Fred." He says, "You mean you're home, Fred?" He says, "Yes." He says, "Well, I'm sorry, Fred. I wanted to talk to your recorder. And would you please put it on, please?" You know, so, and the guy says, "Well, you know, hello, come on, you fellas in there." So the guy says, "Well, what's going on?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "Well, you see, the thing is, many people can't talk to the people any longer directly. Have you ever had the feeling that you're much better on the phone than you are in person?" Seriously, I know guys who just work in phone conversations, like other guys work in marble or clay or halva. You know, some guys use it as a medium. They just work in it. And they chicken out. Listen, I've known a half a dozen chicks who were absolutely fantastic on the telephone. Unbelievable on the telephone. And, you know, I don't have to go any further. I mean, it's just the way it is. And so, in the end, I suppose people live their lives. You know, that kids today can buy a little toy. I guess that the kids wouldn't get it, buy it, but you can get it for kids. The FAO Schwartz people have it, and it's a telephone that the kid can sit and practice telephone conversations, literally. You know, they used to have little plastic phones that kids play with, but it's a telephone that literally talks back to the kid. And, yeah, he can talk to the thing on the phone, and the phone talks back to him, and it goes on for hour after hour after hour, yeah. And it comes with interchangeable tapes. There's an auntie tape you can put in there, and there's an uncle tape. Oh, yes, yeah, so there's a daddy tape. This is for, of course, broken homes. Very good for that. And then there's another kid tape. You know, for kids that don't have friends, they can talk to this other kid, Bobby. You know, there's one kid, one tape called Bobby, another one called Jimmy, another one called Patsy Lee for girls. And you can just talk for hours. And I think it's real training. I think this is truly constructive toy work. I mean, it prepares a kid for life. And you know what life is, you out there. Well, sure you do. You know what life is. You're living it. I mean, don't let anybody else tell you that they know more about life than you do, because you're living it too, you know. We're all in this together. We're all rowing the same boat, or at least we're all bailing the same thing that's sinking. I got a letter from this lady. She said, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, I am a happy woman. I don't know what you're talking about. As a matter of fact, my husband Charles says that you're some kind of a beatnik. And I hate to tell you this, he also says you're a communist." Well, I don't think you're that, actually. I don't know quite what you are, but I have to tell you, I'm a happy woman, signed, a disgruntled ex-listener. And that's an exact copy of a letter. But, I suspect that most people today are involved in some kind of a spirit writing. You know, speaking of spirit writing, and it's Monday and all, you know, I'm sure of it, that most of us have something way down deep inside of us, like a little button mushroom somewhere that has this kind of an obscene face scrawled on it, but a little button mushroom growing way down in the damp, humus, fungus mold of our soul, you know, down there in the basement of our being, down there where the old tires are, and all the dead rats and the stuff that you've thrown away that you don't quite want to throw away, so you stick it down in the basement there. And I ever tell you about the time the guy in our neighborhood read one of these ads in, I believe it was Popular Mechanics, that said, "Earn big money at home growing mushrooms in your basement." They used to say growing mushrooms in your basement was a sure step to big dough. And it says no problem at all to it. All you do is send for the grow your own mushrooms at home kit, and you'll be soon set up in the virgin territory with a door-to-door proposition that just won't stop. It's a fact. And that's true. It says, "Send your name and address to Fungus, Box 6SJ7, Topeka, Kansas." Or was it Fungi? But it's the Fungi is the fun business. But nevertheless, he sent away, and it's a true story. The poor clown was growing mushrooms in his basement, but his family got a little upset. I remember the kid. There was a kid. It was Bobby Anderson, as a matter of fact, now that I think about it. His family couldn't sleep for weeks because, you know what, one thing about mushrooms, you know, mushrooms are not like regular plants, you know that. They're not even like animals. They're something else again. And the family used to have a terrible time sleeping after he started to grow the mushrooms in the basement because you can hear them at night. Oh, yes, in the dark. Oh, true. You know, a mushroom will grow sometimes as many as 4 and 5 feet in 10 minutes in the dark. You know that, Ed. And they make a sound. And when you get a lot of them together, they make an audible sound that comes up through the hot air registers. And you don't like to be reminded of nature that much, you know. No one likes to admit that nature is out there lurking behind the privet hedges. See, we feel that as long as everything is clipped and trimmed and we got a good lawn, that we've got it held at bay. But let me tell you, there is a secret thing that grows down in that deep little dark coal bin of our soul down there, back of that pile of old ashes and clinkers, that tells us that it's out there. As a matter of fact, I have here one of the scariest pictures I've seen in years, and I'm holding it up right now. If you look careful at that transistor thing you got there, you'll see me holding it up there in evidence. It's going to go into my vast file of how it was 1,000 years ago when they dig this jazz up 1,000 years from now. It's from the Chicago Tribune. Now, I don't know whether you know anything about Chicago. I don't know whether anybody knows anything about the Chicago, actually. In fact, you know, they say only the dead know Brooklyn. Well, they say that only the Finks know Chicago. That's a phrase that's out in Chicago. That's true. And I lived in Chicago for a long time, and there's no question about it. I'm a Fink. In fact, I'm a rat Fink, as they used to say on the South. A rat Fink used to holler when I'd go into the pool room. But that's neither here nor there. And you don't really know these places. And Chicago is a big city. It's a big swinging pile of concrete. And it's just like New York, you know, fist fights, hollering in the darkness, and guys spitting and walking along and driving cars and arguing and eating in fancy restaurants. It's just like, you know, just New York. It's 6 and 1/2 dozen the other. Well, from the Chicago Tribune, which, by the way, is one of the great humor dailies in the Western world, the Chicago Tribune, it's got a tongue in its cheek so big that that tongue sometimes stretches all the way up to Milwaukee and all the way as far west as Kalamazoo. But nevertheless, it's got a tongue in its cheek. Mike, did I ever tell you about my Uncle Carl when he wore out all the tires on his Essex, Ed? And they used to do this. A lot of guys did this. Well, when they wear out the tires, this was during the Depression, and they would stuff their tires. Uncle Carl would stuff his tires with paper because his tires wouldn't hold air. It's just simple as that. You can do that. Now, don't look at me disbelievingly. Yes, it is possible. I saw it done. Uncle Carl used to take a whole mess of Chicago Tribune editorial pages, and he'd wet them down. Yes, he said there was nothing tougher than a Chicago Tribune editorial page. Yes, it could stand nails, punctures, anything. And he'd wet it down, see, and he gets it all in a big glop, and he'd pour it into the tire and tamp it down, keep pouring more and more and more in there. And then finally he'd get it on the rim, and he'd hook it up, and he'd drive for years on the Chicago Tribune editorial page alone. He believed in it strongly. He says there is a bulwark of solid protection. And they always advertise General Tires. He used to talk about how great. But anyway, that's the Chicago Trib. So the Chicago, you know how the New York Times just flatly says all the news that's fit to print? They don't allow any argument. I mean, they don't say all the news we think that's fit to print. Nothing like it. Just all the news that's fit to print. Well, the Chicago Tribune does it one step further. They go even further. They say, the other one I think will be good for this one. Now, hold it, Ed. Now, I'll give you the cue. They say, the world's greatest newspaper. Oh, rick-a-thick-a-thick. Come on, all together, gang, now. Oh, here it coming. Oh.
She's got
eyes of blue.
I never cared for eyes of blue.
Well, she's got eyes of blue. And that's my weakness now. Rick-a-thick-a-thick-a-rooty-noose.
Got dimpled cheeks.
I never cared for dimpled cheeks.
She's got dimpled cheeks.
And that's my weakness now.
I cut it out, Bill
and Coo, for crying out loud. It's Monday. Life is real. Life is earnest. Boy, I'll tell you, it is. Well, anyway, from the Chicago Tribune, I want you to listen to this. This is going to give you pause to think, boy. From the Chicago Tribune, there is a sequence of 4 pictures, and they're news photographs. I don't know who took the pictures, but boy, they were really right on the ball. four. Somebody should win a prize for these four pictures, this sequence here. You see in picture number one, and you see the houses in the background, just plain ordinary Chicago type, nothing crummy houses. And it's at 48th and Ellis Avenue. Now, 48th and Ellis is a part of Chicago. It's hard to parallel it here. There's nothing in Manhattan that's quite like 48th and Ellis. This is a part of Chicago that is composed of mostly, and it's not suburban either, you see. Chicago is largely an urban. Well, it's really an urban residential city. We really don't have much of that here in New York, now that I think about it. But when I mean urban residential, it would be as if all of Queens and all of the Bronx and all of Staten Island moved into one great big pile in Manhattan, and that would be Chicago. And they maintain their lawns and stuff, too, though, you see. You know what I mean there? Yeah, they have lawns and stuff. Well, anyway, it's a residential district, Ed. And there they are. You can see the houses. That's what makes it so scary, because the houses look like regular two-story, what they call in Chicago, St. Louis bungalows. Did you ever hear of a St. Louis bungalow? Well, I have a picture here of a St. Louis bungalow. I'll show it to you later here. But they're just ordinary houses, you see, and fat German grandmas live in them, and little skinny, angry ladies who once went to Wheaton College for two semesters and spent a summer handing out tracts, and all of a sudden they met that Bible student, they got married, and now he's working for the Fuller Brush. You know, that whole business. They're all living out there, you see. They're ordinary people, you know, who have skin troubles and watch television and stuff. And you can see the houses in the background, and you can see in the upper right-hand corner a couple little branches of trees. And right in the middle of the picture, you see this great big blur with two enormous wings spread out and about 648 steel-tipped talons reaching down. Yeah, look at that thing diving there. And, oh, boy. And it says here, scenes at 48th and Ellis Avenue yesterday as a golden eagle. Far from its usual haunts, I should say so. I know 48th and Ellis. Attacks a dog. The golden eagle has plummeted out of the sky, and there is a shot taken as he's coming down. He's coming down. He's right there, even with the houses. Somebody was really on the ball. The next scene, he's got a hold of a dog, what we used to call a rat terrier. Yeah, well, you know, it's a little wiry, little sort of a short-haired terrier. He's got a hold of a dog right in the middle of the street. And what is even more ghastly about it is you see an ordinary Ford 1957 Chicago type with a dented rear fender parked in the background, just parked there. And in the foreground is an eagle hanging onto the dog. He's got these big wings. The wingspread is about, what looks like about 5 feet, doesn't it? Great big thing. And in the foreground you see a lady looking. She's standing there and she's got a shopping bag. Boy, and you see a cop and he's shooting at the eagle, and then it says picture two, eagle grips terror-stricken dog in its talons as policeman James Thomas fires his service revolver at the bird. Picture three, dog's owner Fred Goodman attacks with broom while Thomas shoots again. Picture four, bird flies away angrily and perches on chimney, glares at men. Picture five, enormous golden eagle is struck by tranquilizer pellet. Bird shakes it off and flies off to North Woods. Hold it there. Oh, boy. I mean, I'm serious about this. Now, what if you were walking along, say, up on the Grand Concourse, and all of a sudden a golden condor came down and took Fred? Oh! Boy, I'll bet a lot of people in that neighborhood felt that they were finally atoning for their sins. Speaking of sins, this is WORAM at FM New York. Well, let me tell you, you know, have you ever been frightened right out of your skin because of an animal thing? A real animal thing? Now, I'm not talking about a horse kicking you or a dog biting you. I'm talking about a wild animal thing. You fool around with horses, you're going to get kicked. That's it. That's not the kid stuff we're not talking about. You fool around with dogs, one's going to grab you one day. But let me tell you, one time, you know, it's interesting. Most of the people who live in the New York area never really get a chance to run into that wild thing that we're all secretly afraid of. You know, we're descended from a long line of carnivores. And most of us, well, all of us, really, have that secret thing in the back of our mind that there is something lurking outside of our lair. This is in all animals. It's down in all of us. It's there, and you can't get rid of it. No matter how many books you read by Dr. Peel, it's going to be there. It doesn't make any difference how many new cars you buy or how much you make and how much you pay into the Diners Club. It's still there. Doesn't make any difference. It's there, and you can't get rid of it. You cannot blot it out. Well, you know, when you really run into this thing, you just feel like, well, it's finally happened. I knew I was going to get caught by something with big teeth. I knew it. And now here it is, you know. And you start running, and it grabs you again. You run, and it belts you down. You run, you get up, and you run. You hit your head on a rock, and there's no getting away. Well, let me tell you what happened to me one time. I'm just going to describe the scene. Now, you really have to get outside of central New York for these kind of things to happen to you. But when they happen to you, boy, they leave an indelible mark on you, an indelible mark. And I'll tell you what this one was, really how it was involved in my early growing up. And it scared the, well, it did. It scared it all, right out of me. I'm a kid, see, and I'm living in northern Indiana. Well, every summer we used to go up into central Michigan on a vacation. Now, central Michigan is a state pretty much like Wisconsin. Central Michigan is a glacial area. Now, the glacier that moved over Michigan countless eons ago scooped out about 8 million little holes in the ground. As it moved over, it dropped pebbles and stuff as it went. And as it did so, scooping the holes in the ground, it would melt a little bit. And in so melting, it provided the water, it provided the basic material for countless lakes. There must be 8 million lakes in Michigan. You ever been up there, Ed, up in Michigan? Well, there must be a million lakes in Michigan. You know, they advertise Minnesota as the land of 10,000 lakes. Well, actually, there are 11,000 some odd in Minnesota. I would say that there must be easily that many in Wisconsin and probably that many double again in Michigan. It's just that kind of place up. And those three states are literally paved with lakes. Now, I'll tell you what kind of lakes these are, though. These are not the kind of lakes that you're used to up here. The lakes that are in the northern area are largely rock lakes, pebble lakes, sand lakes. And they're craggy lakes. They're clear water lakes here. But the lakes that are scooped out of the peculiar loamy soil of Michigan and Wisconsin are lakes that have a quality all of their own. First of all, the bottoms of them usually are thick silt. If you get down to the bottom of a lake in Michigan, for example, you'll sink right up to your neck immediately in mud. Now, they call it mud up there, but actually it isn't mud. It's a kind of a silt. It's a gathering of countless generations of weeds that have drifted to the bottom. Now, that's another thing. The bottom of Michigan lakes are covered with enormous weeds that reach up. And if you look down into the clear water, sometimes you can see these weeds just reaching up, millions of them reaching up with great fingers. And as the water slowly shifts a little bit, there's a little current, these big weeds move back and forth like great waves under there. It's very scary. Sometimes you tug, when you've thrown your anchor into one of these weed beds, you can pull on your anchor for maybe 15 or 20 minutes before you pull it out. And as you pull your anchor up, you can see long, great mobs of weeds trailing after it. And the water is usually dark green, almost black. It's so dark. And the water itself is interesting, too, because these weeds are continually flowering. And as they flower, what they call flowering, it's underwater growth, It fills the water with countless bits of little white dot-like material. It's a seeds or something. I don't know what it is, but it's from the weeds. It's like millions and millions of little protozoans just floating in the water under there. So as you look down, if you dive under the water, it's all fresh water, by the way. As you dive under the water and you look out look around. It's as though there's a faint snowstorm ahead of you all the time when the weeds are flowering. Now, if you look enough at this water, your imagination can form pictures of things that are there, and just the way it is, that just it just doesn't stop. You know, you know how these guys must feel about the Loch Ness monster. You just has to be a monster there. Nobody's seen it, but there's got to be one there. Just the way the place is, you know, it's Monsterville. Well, I'm there, you know, and I used to float out and at about twilight, and I would cast for bass. Well, now I'm a kid, you see, and I'm a notably unsuccessful fisherman. I was great with the bluegills. I was very good with some fish, and I was even pretty good with the perch, with the yellow perch. But every night I would float out. These lakes just lay there. That's another thing about these lakes. There is a certain still, ominous quality about them. And all around the edges of the lakes are these great growths of lily pads and bulrushes that reach up. And dark, dead trees. That's a fascinating part of it, too. There are thousands of trees standing in the water. Because, you see, this goes back, countless years. Some of these trees are very ancient trees, standing in the water, just reaching up. And so at maybe, quarter to seven, quarter to eight at night, when you drift next to these things, anything is possible in these trees. And these trees are all a sort of a gray, whitish color, and they catch the light in the moon glow. And the water just lies in between them, and at the end of each lake is the what they call the marsh. Now, these lakes are not as definite as eastern lakes. They're very indefinite lakes. They sort of just trail off in the marshy areas. There's no beaches on them either, the way you know a beach here, you see. They're just sort of laying in the hills there, and they trail off into marshes and strange, dark, dead, petrified forests and one thing and another. Oh, they're very scary places. And that's, these lakes sometimes will be, some of them will be as long as 5-6 miles long. Some of them are just a mile. Some of them are just a quarter of a mile. Some of them are just a block round. But they're all definitely lakes. They're not ponds at all. There's a distinct lake quality about them. And some of them are very deep because this glacier would scoop it out way down deep and then cut up high. Glaciers are tricky affairs. So once in a while, one of these lakes will be as much as 100 to 150 feet deep. You know, the Great Lakes themselves are the result of that same glacier. And that enormous ice sheet that dug the five Great Lakes out trailed off on either side. You see, that sheet, that ice sheet was not really even. And so if you look on your map, you'll find that Michigan is astride one of the lakes, and Wisconsin is on the other side, and Minnesota hangs on the bottom of Lake Superior. So these are the results of the later days of the glacier when it was melting, when it was beginning to lose its weight, you see, and it wasn't scooping out the lakes the way it had, the big Great Lakes, and now it's just skipping, you know, making little lakes all over the place. In fact, much of the state of Michigan, and certainly a lot of the northern Indiana where I lived, had been underwater. When we would walk around on the ground where we were, when the kids would dig up caves, for example, we would continually dig up shells. We would dig up all kinds of seashells and stuff because where we lived had been underwater at one time. Much of northern Indiana had. So it was a sandy, loamy, peculiar, spooky countryside. And they grew great grapes in that area. Because the sand and the soil was mixed in such a way that it was great grape country. Have you heard of the grapes of Michigan? It's a big deal. They grow the big purple grapes. They don't grow wine grapes. They grow another kind of grape. And it's the kind of grape that they make grape jelly out of and preserves and so on. So this is the kind of country. Can you see it now? Over every hill, when you drive in Michigan, there's a lake. And as you drive along all the little gravel roads, there's a little sign that'll say Clear Lake. Just a little handmade sign, Clear Lake, that way. Or else it'll say Rifle Lake. Or it'll say Minnewaska Lake. Or Lake Dowagiac. Hundreds of them have Indian names, and many of them are just not even named at all. They're just there, the lake, that's all. And some of them have nobody living on them. Maybe there's one old farm there, and there's a lake hanging down there somewhere. And all of them are rimmed by these ancient farms. So one day, and you know, it's funny, when you live in an area like that, or at least spend any time there, you always feel that there's something terrible out there. something. You don't know what it is. It's something out there. And it's, I guess we're all afraid of water, dark water, deep water. We're all afraid of the weeds. Every one of us. There isn't one of us that isn't afraid of the weeds. You know that. And so I'm out there one night, and it's about 7 or 8 o'clock, and it's just getting dark. And I have my split bamboo rod. I'm about 10 years old. And I'm floating in this wooden rowboat, and I'm floating in among the trees, these great big old trees that are hanging up over me. Now, these trees did not have branches or anything like that atop of them. They were just maybe 15 feet. They'd stick out of the water. Dark, gnarled, gray shapes. That's all they were. Just there. And as I'd row once in a while, I'd bump into one. You'd feel it scrape on the bottom. And you float. And the water is dark. And you can see the weeds once in a while waving there. And a few lily pads. So I'm casting for bass. Now, this was a good bass lake, and once in a while I would catch a bass, but I was a terrible fisherman. I was just a kid, you know, and when my plug hit the water, it was like a doorknob landing from four stories up. You know, that kind of... Well, you know, even the nuttiest bass is not going to be fooled by this much. And once in a while I'd get a... And even among bass, you know, there are the smart ones and there are the dumb ones. And once in a while I'd get a dumb one. And usually it was an adolescent bass, you know, the kind about 9 inches long... that would come along bugged, you know, and the old man is told, lay off that. Well, that's a doorknob. For crying out loud, there's some kid flopping around up there. And then bang, that bass would hit, and I'd get him, you see. Throw him back in. Well, one night I'm out there, and I'm just throwing this thing out the way. And I had this terrible $2 reel. I had backlashes. Let me tell you, do you know that that reel is still in my closet back home where my mother lives? And the reason it's in that closet is because I have promised myself every year that I'm going to untangle the final backlash that I got. I got a backlash, believe me, that weighs over 4.5 pounds, that backlash, and it makes the Gordian knot look like a granny knot. I'm serious. That backlash, it was, I'll never forget the night that happened, but that, any of you fishermen, you know exactly what I'm talking. I was fishing one night, and I laid it out there, and the plug was about 20 feet in the air and going out when all of a sudden... It stopped. The reel kept going, and I just saw this big thing growing. It was like a fungus growing in my hand, this backlash. Well, I gave up. That's when I quit fishing. So sometime when I retire, you know, some guys are going to retire to write a book. Other guys are going to write a play. Some guys are going to become sculptors. I'm going to retire and untangle the knot. I figure it'll take me about 9 or 10 years of good hard work. But I'm looking forward to it, too. It's very restful. Well, anyway, this night, see, I'm casting with my $2 reel and this rotten rod that I had that had the loose ferrules and everything on it, and I'm floating along there in my boat, and I know I'm about an hour past when I should be out, you know? And I can see the cottages all around the lake are kind of lit up, and you can hear the radios playing, and you can smell the kerosene lamps. They use kerosene lamps in those cottages, yeah, because they didn't have electricity. They didn't allow electricity on the lake. And so you could smell the kerosene all the way out in the middle of the lake, you know? Kerosene lamps burning, and you can hear the people talking. Well, I'm floating there, and I'm casting. It's plopping out there. Once in a while, I'd hook a weed and reel it in, unhook the weed. Okay. Well, I'm doing this, you know, and I'm sort of floating, and I'm half asleep, and I'm just, you know, I hadn't caught anything like this for weeks. And I lay it out there, and it goes, plow, plow, show, blah, 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 wow, blow, plow, boom, plow, blah, 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 plow. Well, before I knew what happened, the reel is going, whee! I lay my thumb on that thing, and I am scared to death, you know. And I stop it, and I burn my thumb, and it goes. I throw my back into it, and I lean back into it, and pow! Whatever it is clearing water. Boom! Pow! Well, I'll tell you, whatever it was, that thing must have gone. I couldn't see anything in the darkness, and that's what scared me. It just went, blow! And I'm leaning back on this thing and I'm playing it. I figure I got the biggest bass in the lake on there, you know, and I've got this fantastic fish. Well, I'm playing it, and it's all the dreams that any fisherman has ever had come true. This thing is not coming in an inch. It's going out. And I'm, you know, I've got my little cheapy 50-cent line on there, you know, my 400-pound test line, that stuff that looks like clothesline, you know, it's paying out, and my reel is getting empty, and I keep leaning back, and then suddenly she comes in at me. You know what they do, you know, they start rushing the boat. Everything rushes the boat in the end, you know, and this thing comes raining, and I'm reeling this thing in as fast as I can. The line is slack, and suddenly it goes under the boat. My rod bends over double, and it's under the boat, and I hear something hit the bottom of the boat. Oh, boy. This time he's heading for open water. Whee! Pow! Whee! And he gets out, I'd say, about... Oh, he must have been about 150 feet out. Out in that dark water, and it's getting dark. It's getting darker than the ace of spades now, and it is black out there, and the water is black, and he clears water again. Sploosh! And I'm sitting there, and then the boat, I'm trying to row it out of these crummy logs, you know, I'm trying to get out, and I'm pushing away, and finally I get out in the open water, and this thing keeps going. He heads back to the logs again. Back and forth we go. I'm going to tell you the truth. We went back and forth. It must have been 3/4 of an hour. One of the wildest things that ever happened to me in my life. And by the time this thing is beginning to get closer to the boat, I'm getting scared. Literally getting scared. By now, it is a big, dark thing out in that blackness. That's all it is. It ain't a fish anymore. And he just keeps going, wah, wah. Once in a while, I hear something hit the water, and down he goes. He'd sound then. And so I'm sitting there. One time, this thing sounded and just sat. He must have sat for about 5 minutes. And I figure it's hooked on the bottom, you know, because all the time you're getting logs. So I roll over the line, and my line is just as taut as a piece of barbed wire. And I've got that old pole bent over, and I keep wiggling up and down. And suddenly, this thing starts heading out again. Woo! And boy, my poor little old reel is smoking, and I am scared to death. And there's nobody around. There isn't a boat. There is nothing around for miles. And there I am. I can see those houses, and I'm out there fighting this monster. And I'm getting scared and scared, and boom, pow! Ow! He hits twice against the side of the boat. That sound I'll never forget. You can't see anything. You just boom. This heavy, solid thing hitting up against the boat. Well, finally, after about 45 minutes, it's kind of slowing up. And it's a heavy drag, but it's still struggling. Well, I reaches down, I takes my line, I've got it right up next to the boat. Remember, I'm a kid of about 10 years old. I reach down, and I have this swivel. And on the end of the swivel, I have about, maybe 4 or 5 or 6 inches of heavy gut leader. And at the end of the gut leader, I had another swivel. And at the end of the swivel, I had my homemade plug, which I had made over the winter. I used to carve plugs out of broomsticks. And I'll never forget, this was the worst-looking plug. It looked great as wood, but I had painted it a kind of peculiar pink. I figured they could really see that. Well, whatever it is, really saw this son of a gun. And I can see it down there. I can see my plug, and I can't see anything else except a dark thing down there. But I can see the plug moving, just moving ever so slightly down there in the darkness, maybe 6 or 7 inches below the surface of the water. Well, I reach down. I figure, well, you know, it's a fish. It can't be. And I'm real scared. And yet at the same time, so I reach down and I start to pull the thing up. And this tail, this gigantic plow, pow, 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 pow. Oh. Well, he smashes that water about 4 or 5 times, and I pay out a little of the line, and I sit there. I don't know what to do. Well, finally, I figure, well, the best thing to do is to edge out to clear water, get out of these logs, because I've gotten back into the logs, and I'm among the weeds and stuff, so that's really trouble. So I'm holding one end of the line, and I've got the oar, and I'm pushing away at the logs, and I finally get drifting out, and he's following. And now I'm about maybe 15 or 20 feet from the nearest log, and I reach down. And this is the only thing you can do when you don't have a gaff or anything. You know, a gaff to me was a thing you only read about in sporting goods magazines, you know, and in Field and Stream, guys using gaffs and landing nets. You know, these are big timers. I'm a kid. I'm fishing for sunfish. I'm a gaff. You don't gaff a perch 4.5 inches long, you know. So I'm reaching down, and I grab that line, and I just, it, heavy, boy, I'll tell you, I just went whoop like that into the boat. And it went blah, 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 pow, 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 pow. And he's down there under the next seat, and he is banging away. He is just banging and banging and banging and banging away. Well, I figure I have landed the biggest bass in the lake. Well, I had this tackle box. Now, remember, I'm a good Cub Scout. And one of the things that all guys have in the tackle box, Ed, if you remember, was this little Bakelite waterproof matchbox. You know, that little tubular kind with the thing that screws on. That's one of the first things that a Boy Scout kid gets for a Christmas gift. And you know, how many times can he use a waterproof matchbox? Well, I've got a waterproof matchbox because my old man used to go fishing with me, and he used it all the time to light his cigarettes. So I reach in there, and I unscrew this thing, and I light one of the matches. It's got a little abrasive thing on the top. I look down. Ah! Unbelievable! Ah! Oh! There, laying in the darkness, lit up by my match, is I had never in my life ever seen anything like this. To this day, I haven't seen anything like it. This thing was about, I would say roughly he was about 3 feet long, 2.5 to 3 feet long, a big baby. And he is a strange blackish golden color, one of the most beautiful golden colors I've ever seen, with a kind of a peculiar whitish gold silver belly that ran the entire length of him. He had a mouth. I would say roughly this mouth was 6 inches round. And in that mouth, under the light of my yellow match burning, I could see at least 455 enormous yellow canine teeth. And his mouth is just working. He's laying there, and he has his huge eye just looking up, a kind of yellow, golden, red eye. And that eye was about the size of a quarter. And down at the end is a strange square tail, the likes of which I've never seen before. Well, I retreat. I retreat to the under end of the boat, and I just hang there. The light is out, the match is burned out, and I'm in darkness again. I have landed the monster that I have always been afraid is at the bottom of every lake. And he's laying down there, making a kind of a peculiar clicking, hissing sound. And once in a while, his tail goes blump, blump. Well, blump, blump. And I am starting to cry. I'm getting that terrible scared sound, and I'm afraid to go down at the end of the boat where the oar is. Well, I have to do it. Well, I get down there, and he's laying about 3.5 feet, maybe 4 feet away from where I'm rowing. And once in a while, I go, boom, and I'm rowing. I'm rowing through the darkness. Boom, he goes. And I'm afraid to touch the line. I'm afraid to do anything. He you know, he just landed. Boom, and I'm rowing. Well, I row, and I row, and I row. And about every third or fourth stroke, boom. Oh, wow. The old oar locks go, whoop, clunk, whoop, clunk. Well, I'm about 75 feet off of our dock, and the lake is as black as the inside of my baseball cap. You know, you can't even see the docks, you can't see anything, and I see all those yellow houses up there, and I said, I'm like, hey, Dad, hey, Mom, hey, help, hey, Mom, hey, Randy. I'm hollering for everybody, and about 25 people start pouring out. Well, I can see flashlights and stuff. Well, I come rolling up to one of the docks, And I say, I caught a funny thing. It's a terrible thing. And all the guys come rushing down into the rowboat, and I jump up on the dock. And they've got the lights and those great big Coleman lamps, you know, and they're looking down. And some guy says, "Oh, for God's sakes." And they're all looking down. "Hey, Ernie, look at, for God's sakes, look at that, will you?" And they're looking down. There's about 9 old-time fishermen. And one of them says, "The biggest one I ever saw. Get the 22, Emily. Get the 22. Well, Emily goes running up to get the 22. And I can see all the fishermen are pouring out of the darkness, and there's about 45 of them down on the docks. I said, "Look at that. Look at that. Get the 22. Well, they get the 22. And I hear that, like that. And by now, I'm all the way up on the beach. I am scared. I am sweating. Well, Ernie comes back, and he says, "Where's the kid that caught that?" And it's me, you know. I said, "I'm the kid that caught it." He says, "Kid, that is the biggest golden dogfish that I have ever seen in this lake. And I have been fishing in this lake for 35 years. Kid, you caught the biggest, toughest golden dogfish probably in the state of Michigan." I said, "What? What kind of, it's a fish?" I figured it was an evil spirit, you know, it's a fish. I automatically felt better because, you know, it's a fish. I know about fish. I said, what kind of a fish? He says, "Son, that was a golden dogfish. Do you know what a golden dogfish is, kid?" "It's terrible." "You're right. You're damn right it's terrible. Let me tell you, kid, a golden dogfish will eat a full-grown mallard duck on the wing. And it has been reputed that a golden dogfish will eat a full-grown kid on the wing, provided he's hungry enough and provided he's got a bad tooth. Son, you have caught a golden dogfish. And I suspect you can get yourself a big fat bounty if you care to. In fact, if you'd like to have those teeth mounted on your watch chain, I'll do it for you. Kid, you caught the biggest golden dogfish in the state of Michigan." "The biggest one, huh?" Yeah, well, that's my plug, you know. I was out there fishing. I figured I was going out after dogfish, you know. The fishing. I said, "Well, kid, you really done it." Well, I want to tell you, I did not sleep for 3 straight nights. And as a matter of fact, I'd say once every 6 or 7 months, I have a fleeting vision in the darkness of the night of maybe 455 dark yellow, long, golden canine teeth at the bottom of an endless well.